At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now here's a phrase you haven't heard in a while. Too big to fail. That, of course, is what helped get us into this whole mess. Now, though, big banks are selling themselves off piecemeal, which means somebody's going to buy those parts and become... yeah, that's right. Too big to fail. What goes around comes around on Wall Street from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 14th of January today, and the bargain stock of this day is an easy one to pick. The single-letter ticker symbol, C. Citigroup closed down 23%, under $5 a share, for what was once the biggest financial institution in this country. The decision earlier this week to spin off its brokerage unit, Smith Barney, didn't help any, and Citi seems to be getting ready to put some of its other businesses up for sale as well. It's tantamount to a fire sale, all the more notable because size was Citi's claim to fame, a one-stop financial supermarket, if you will. But as is true with stocks themselves, for every seller there is a buyer. And Marketplace's Steve Henn reports Citi's breakup might just lead to industry consolidation all over again.
Sandy Weill, who built Citi into a banking colossus, started with a vision. He hoped to combine stockbrokers, bankers, and insurance agents to offer every conceivable financial service under one roof. By the end of the 90s, it looked like Weill succeeded.
Buying Travelers and then buying Salomon Brothers and then merging with Citicorp to really have a great, great global franchise.
Even as the financial crisis kicked off in the summer of 2007, Weill told Charlie Rose his vision still made sense.
We had the most equity of any company in the financial business, operating in over 100 countries, a lot of them for nearly 100 years.
Now, most of that equity is gone, and Citi's storied history no longer matters.
The financial supermarket model is, in fact, dead.
William Smith is a Citigroup shareholder. He called for breaking up the banking giant more than 2.5 years ago, when it was trading at $50 a share. Now, with Citi selling for less than $5 a share, he's getting his wish.
The model doesn't work.
Smith says if the financial crisis taught consumers anything, it's that you don't want all your investments under one roof. But banking analyst Bert Ely says that dream lives on.
I don't think the supermarket model dies with Citi, but the next iteration of it may look a lot different.
The new giants will have fewer businesses. But with banks selling so cheap, Stuart Plesser at Standard & Poor's says the next era of financial consolidation has already begun.
And it will likely continue in 2009 as the stronger banks pick up some of the weaker banks.
But Plesser says Citi's an unlikely takeover target. It's simply too big for any other bank to digest. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Change has come relatively quickly for Citigroup. Not so, though, for Nortel Networks. The telecommunications firm has been trying to stage a comeback since the dot-com bust. But the good fight ended today when Nortel filed for bankruptcy protection. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from the Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
You might not be familiar with the Nortel logo or even know what the company does, but Carmi Levy at AR Communications says Nortel's an integral part of modern connectivity.
Every single activity that you do through phone, through television, through internet, at some point uses Nortel technology, and so this will have a huge impact.
The 112-year-old company is North America's biggest maker of telephone equipment, Toronto's shining example of telecom excellence. But just like a gadget geek hooked on the latest mobile app, Nortel spent with wild abandon during the dot-com bubble. Analyst Brian Modoff with Deutsche Bank says Nortel's debt piled up high and the recession took it over the edge.
This is a company that massively overpaid for other companies during the bubble, which ruined their balance sheet. They went through a series of restructurings that were never quite enough.
But it wasn't just finances. Nortel messed up the technical manual, despite a heavy R&D budget. Analyst Mark McKechnie at Broadpoint Amtech says it picked the wrong mobile networking technology, 4G, instead of the more popular 3G.
Product cycles in telecom are 8 years long. If you miss a product cycle in telecom, it's going to take you a long time to come back.
If you come back at all. Nortel says the restructuring will help strengthen business. It could seek a government bailout or just wait for offers from competitors eager to scoop up what's left of a legacy. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We learned today that business inventories were down for a third straight month in November. The actual number was 0.7% down. That's according to the Commerce Department. Sometimes it's a good thing when that happens. It can mean goods are flying off assembly lines and out of warehouses and into the backs of our SUVs at the shopping mall. Now's not one of those times. Instead, inventories are falling because businesses are putting orders on hold as sales continue to plummet, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The number to keep an eye on here is something called the inventory to sales ratio. It tells us how long it's taking businesses to sell what they've already got sitting on shelves. It was up to 1.41 months in November, the highest since the 2001 recession. Bernard Baumol of the Economic Outlook Group says we're in a downward spiral.
Because as fewer shoppers come to the stores, it's going to take even longer for these retailers to sell off their goods. And there is certainly no reason at that point for retailers to order more stuff from their factories or from their wholesalers.
You can see where this is going. The factories and wholesalers lay people off. Those people don't go shopping for a pair of shoes or a new car, which is what auto dealer Ray Sicolo is grappling with.
Well, I've never seen anything quite like this.
Sicolo has been selling cars for 46 years. He's got 7 dealerships in the Boston area. At first, he couldn't sell SUVs.
And then gas prices collapsed, and we found that the bigger cars were selling, and the small cars stopped selling. But in general, we still have too much inventory.
The average dealership now has 2.5 months' worth of cars sitting on its lot, and that glut of inventory has been rising for more than a year, leading to Sicolo's final point.
There couldn't be a more perfect time for a consumer to buy a car.
Which would start feeding back to the automakers and help get the economy going again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Before we tease the markets, and trust me, you are not in any hurry to get there, a couple of corrections today. On the broadcast Monday, we said Congress cut a bailout check for the auto companies. It's true Congress did approve the $700 billion in overall TARP money, but it was the Bush administration that decided Detroit would get some of it. Also on Monday, in a story about banks under investigation for helping customers get around U.S. economic sanctions, we lumped Lloyd's of London in where it didn't belong. That Lloyd's is an insurance company. We should have said Lloyd's TSB in setting up that story. By any name, it was ugly on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It was back to the good old days of last fall on Wall Street today. 3.5% losses on the major indices. The Dow at its lowest level since the 1st of December. Nothing like the fallout from a bubble economy to make the markets crazy. Problem is, those bubbles make the rest of us crazy, too. They're bad enough on the way up, let alone on the way down like now. Economist Dean Baker explores the causes and solutions in his new book, Plunder and Blunder, it's called. Mr. Baker, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, you start this book by saying that bubbles aren't natural, but I thought the way economies in capitalism worked was that everybody gets excited about something, bids it way up, the enthusiasm goes away, there's a crash, and then we do it all over again like 8 or 10 years later.
Well, you could identify certainly many bubbles in the history of capitalism, but you could also identify long periods of time where we didn't have any bubbles. So, for example, if we look at the post-war period from 45 right through the 70s, there was nothing resembling any significant bubble of any consequence for the economy. During that period, you had an economy in which prosperity was broadly shared. Workers were getting their share of productivity growth. And you had what at least I would call, or I should say many people would call, a virtuous circle where increased productivity led to greater wage growth, which led to more consumption, more investment, more productivity. So I wouldn't say that you necessarily are going to have bubbles as part of a capitalist economy. You can, but I think that's a sign of a mismanaged economy.
Let me pick up on your timeline there. What happened 30 years ago to change things?
I associate a lot of this with policies that were pursued by the Reagan administration, and in many ways quite deliberate and explicit policies to weaken the power of labor unions, weaken the power of workers, which had the effect of redistributing income upwards. So you had policies, for example, he quite explicitly wanted to weaken unions by, well, he fired the PATCO, the air traffic controllers, back in 1981, and that set a new standard where suddenly workers who went on strike could be fired. That really wasn't done prior to that.
There's been a Democratic president since Reagan. Did Bill Clinton have anything to do with this?
I think in many ways he continued the policies of the Reagan era. In some ways he was different, but in some ways he continued them, most notably with trade, for example. His trade agenda was very much about putting U.S. manufacturing workers in direct competition with low-wage workers across the world. So that puts downward pressure on wages. And that's really just straight out of the economic textbooks. That's what the gains from trade are supposed to result in, is cheaper cars. But a side effect of that is we paying our auto workers less money. They're getting lower wages. So I think in many ways, Clinton actually picked up on some of the policies of the Reagan era that led to this upward redistribution of income.
Continue on this presidential timeline that we started with here. Let me know what you think about President-elect Obama and where his policies might take this economy in terms of avoiding these kinds of bubbles.
I think an awful lot is up for grabs at this moment, because his decisions are going to restructure the economy in very fundamental ways, whether he wants to or not. Now, if he adopts policies that are quite consciously designed to promote, say, the bottom and middle half of the workforce, promote manufacturing, promote construction, then I think it might take us back on the path of sort of broadly shared prosperity that we had in the three decades following World War II. At the same time, though, he obviously has people who are very closely tied to the financial industry, holding high positions in his administration. Certainly, Larry Summers, his pick for National Economic Advisor, and Timothy Geithner, his pick for Treasury Secretary. And they may want to take the economy a different direction. So this is going to be a very big battle in the first years of the Obama administration.
Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. His new book is called Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Mr. Baker, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Tomorrow, the British government is set to announce a plan to relieve the congestion at London's Heathrow Airport. Because Heathrow's not just busy, it's at the breaking point. The two runways it has can't really handle any more traffic. So the government is expected to say it's going to build a third one. But protesters have hit on a plan to stop construction of that three-mile-long strip of concrete. A good old-fashioned land grab. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
A group of environmental protesters has bought a one-acre field close to Heathrow. It lies directly in the path of the airport's proposed third runway. Activist Leo Murray says the plan is to split the land up into tiny squares and give title to as many people as possible, tangling the whole deal up in red tape.
There are hundreds of people who've been given these parcels of land, including MPs from all three major parties. And we've just heard Emma Thompson, you know, an Oscar-winning actress. This actually represents a serious legal spanner in the works for the people that are pushing this third runway.
If Heathrow gets permission to build the runway, the protesters will be forced to sell the field. But dealing with hundreds of owners, some as far away as the Canadian Arctic, won't be easy. That's the point, says organiser Zach Goldsmith. The idea is to slow down the whole process.
We can delay that quite a long time. And the idea really is to delay it till beyond the election. And that way, I think we probably do kill this project altogether.
The next election is due within 18 months. The opposition Conservatives say if they win, they'll scrap any plans for another runway at Heathrow. Arguments over this have raged for years. Opponents say the world's busiest international airport shouldn't get any busier. But Heathrow is full. Expansion is an economic necessity, says airport spokesman Tom Kelly.
Whether you need to fly to LA for the Golden Globes or to Shanghai for business, this country needs long-haul flights, and only Heathrow has the volume of traffic to make those long-haul flights viable.
Aptly enough, the struggle over the runway has gone global. 7,000 people from all over the world have applied to become part owners of the Heathrow field. But planning lawyer Ian Traherne claims that this ploy may not work. New planning laws mean that the authorities may be able to dismiss the ownership issues as a nuisance.
It would be perfectly lawful for the Infrastructure Planning Commission, which will make the decision, to disregard the fact that the land has been chopped up into many, many different little pieces.
The government is expected to give the go-ahead for the third runway tomorrow. Now that scruffy little field on the perimeter of Heathrow becomes the latest battleground for Britain's aviation industry. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, the language of a global market.
Ngizizwa nginenhlanhla. I'm feeling lucky.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bad news from banks confirmed investors' fears today dragged the whole market down. They did. The Dow Industrials dropped 248 points, nearly 3%, finished at 8,200. The NASDAQ dropped 56 points, that's 3.75%, closed at 1489. The S&P 500 lost 29 points, 3.75%, ended the day at 842. As I said, the financial sector got whacked today. Citigroup fell 23%. Deutsche Bank and Morgan Stanley both lost more than 8%. Bank of America was off 4%. Sports apparel maker Under Armour has been tackled by the poor economy. Get it? Tackled. Its stock dropped 13% after missing the mark on earnings today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for December. The Senate Budget Committee discusses the national debt. And though the national holiday honoring Martin Luther King Jr. isn't until next week, the anniversary of his birth is actually tomorrow, January 15th. He would have been 80. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You remember the S-chip debate from a couple of years ago, whether to bump up cigarette taxes to pay for an expansion of the state children's health insurance program, S-chip? Congress said yes. The president said no, said it twice, in fact, with vetoes. Today, the House said yes yet again as part of President-elect Obama's promise of universal health care. Commentator Robert Reich says that support is exactly the kind of thing people need until economic help arrives.
The safety net created in the 1930s to protect Americans from extreme poverty is in tatters. Now that we're in the worst downturn since the Depression, that safety net needs mending. This should be a key part of any stimulus plan. Unemployment insurance, for example, was created in 1935, when most people who lost jobs had held those full-time positions for some years. But most people who are losing jobs now have not been in them all that long. Typically, the last ones hired are the first fired. And many job losers have only worked part-time. Either way, they don't qualify for unemployment benefits. In fact, fewer than 40% of people now losing their jobs qualify. So a necessary step toward mending our safety net is to get unemployment benefits to everyone who loses a job. And if it's a part-time job, partial benefits. And remember welfare? We started that program in the depths of the Depression. We officially abolished it in 1996, during the strongest job-creating recovery in memory. We substituted a new law that gives people a maximum of 60 months in their lifetimes to get aid for themselves and their kids. Over the last dozen years, as more and more people hit that 60-month limit, the nation's welfare rolls naturally declined, even though the percent of families in poverty stayed roughly the same, just under 10%. But now, as the economy plunges, many more families are moving toward poverty. So that 60-month limit should be lifted, at least until the economy turns up again. Giving American families more economic security during this downturn isn't just fair. It's also good policy, because the money they get to buy goods and services keeps other people in their jobs. In fact, strengthening our national safety net is one of the fastest and most direct ways to stimulate the economy. And after all, if executives on Wall Street and in Detroit deserve a safety net, why should American families be left out in the cold?
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Super Capitalism. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Just look for that link that says contact. There's a television ad that's been in pretty heavy rotation the past couple of weeks. It's an ad about television and the coming conversion from analog to digital over-the-air TV signals. The big question now is when it's actually coming. The switch had been set for February until the government fund to help people buy the necessary converter boxes ran out of money. The president-elect's people have said he wants a delay, but that could put a lot of television stations on the fritz, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
For months, TV stations have been running public service announcements.
At midnight on February 17, 2009, all televisions will switch from analog to 100% digital.
The government is funding $40 coupons for digital converter boxes, but lots of people are still waiting.
There are currently at this point in time about 2 million coupon requests on the waiting list.
That's Bart Forbes, spokesman for the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which oversees the coupon program. Because of congressional restrictions, the agency has to wait and see how many coupons are used before issuing new ones.
If they don't use that coupon, it expires, and so we can then recycle that $40 to send out another coupon.
If the transition is delayed, TV stations face additional expenses. Bill Fee is general manager of WCPO-TV, the NBC affiliate in Cincinnati. His station now broadcasts in digital and analog.
In WCPO's case, it's several thousand dollars a month for the analog signal.
Fee says many stations aren't prepared for the extra costs.
That additional cost has not been budgeted by any of the TV stations past February 18th.
Remember that public service announcement? A delay would force stations to run new PSAs to update viewers. That space might otherwise have been sold to a paying advertiser. On the other side, first responders are waiting to inherit the old analog airwaves. So a new and improved 911 may be put on hold. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Try though they might, Chinese censors can't shut off the internet entirely. The number of Chinese online jumped more than 40% last year. That means there are now almost as many people surfing the web there as there are that live in the United States, almost 300 million people. It amounts to about 22% of the total Chinese population. Not every culture is so connected, though. Best estimates are that only 5% or so of Africans used the internet last year. The growing digital divide in the developing world has been created by a shortage of computers, high-speed access, and electricity, and as Gretchen Wilson reports, language.
Joyce Biela has sold brooms, floor mats, and baskets at this market for more than 30 years. Every night, she tracks her sales and inventory in a dog-eared notebook. Her daughter says a computer would boost productivity and take Biela's small business to the next level.
Because she will do balancing, loss, profit, do everything in computer, not manually.
But Biela's never used a computer.
I speak Zulu, so I don't know how computers work.
That's because PCs here use English language versions of Microsoft Windows and Office. It's a huge barrier.
In order for technology to really be beneficial to a community, it has to be well utilized.
Lauren Woodman is head of Microsoft's public sector programs. She says the company's products are usually offered in dozens of languages, like Spanish, Chinese, and Arabic.
But there are lots and lots of other languages out there that have much smaller populations or may not be as commercially accessible, but still do serve large communities.
So Microsoft offers free downloads of what they call interface packs in 37 additional languages. They're like shells that sit on top of an existing version of Windows or Office. So instead of clicking File and seeing a menu with the words New, Open, and Save, a Zulu speaker clicks
Ifayela
and sees
Encha, Vula, Londoloza.
Okay.
This is a computer lab in Kwadukuza. A facilitator leads a dozen Zulu speakers through the basics. Di Gumere is a high school teacher. Like many Zulu speakers, he speaks English as a second language. Up until now, he found computers kind of intimidating.
Many people are still, like, scared to go and learn computers.
But since this Zulu language technology was put in place, this computer lab has seen its membership skyrocket by more than 30%. Microsoft offers its products in local languages in part as a survival strategy. After all, it faces competition from other technologies that use indigenous languages, cell phones, open-source operating systems, and internet-based technologies. Sipo Mkize is studying small business management and uses the internet to look for jobs. He points to a button on Google's Zulu language search engine.
I'm feeling lucky.
Some indigenous groups don't feel lucky at all to have their language used this way. In fact, some are fighting it. The Mapuche in Chile accused Microsoft of intellectual piracy when it developed Windows in their language. But Mkize, the business student, has a different view.
It's kind of like a step forward, and it's a good thing.
Mkize says technology that speaks his language is exactly what he needs to navigate in the modern era. In Kwadukuza, South Africa, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a follow-up to the news last week that Apple's Steve Jobs was having more health problems. At the time, we thought, because Apple told us, that it was nothing more than a hormonal imbalance. This afternoon, we learned it's a bit more serious than that, though we don't know exactly how bad. In an email to Apple employees, Jobs said he's taking a leave of absence through June. Jobs survived pancreatic cancer 4 years ago. Both he and the company have taken heat for not being more forthcoming about his health issues. Apple shares closed at $87.25 today. It'll be interesting to see where they open up tomorrow. When they do, we'll be here. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow tumbled 248 points, nearly 3%, to finish at 8,200. The NASDAQ dropped 56 points. That's 3 2/3%, closed at 1489. The S&P 500 lost 29 points, 3 1/3%, ended the day at 842. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, you thought Wall Street was a crazy place to work.
We play drums and turn a rope, and on the end is special small balls.
It's another installment of our series, Working. It's a circus, people. It's a circus. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.